Hello, I'm Garni Barkajarian of the Pacific Neuroscience Institute and CNS member for more than 10 years. What I love most about being a member is access to cutting-edge science and the opportunities that have advanced my career. I've also gained new colleagues and lifelong friends. Being a CNS member has been so rewarding. The value of membership cannot be defined by a number. Join me and the over 10,000 neurosurgeons who are making a difference in the world. Visit cns.org/membership podcast today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the April 2024 edition of the CNS Journal Club podcast. My name is Jeffrey Traylor, and I'm a resident at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, and I'll be the moderator for today's discussion. Today, we'll be talking about the article Lower Cranial Nerve Schwannomas, Cohort Study and Systematic Review. And we're fortunate enough to have the senior author, Dr. Michael Link, here from the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Link, would you mind introducing yourself for us?
Hi, my name is Michael Link. I'm a neurosurgeon at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And my practice is centered on the diagnosis and treatment of skull-based disorders, particularly skull-based tumors. And I have a busy operative practice, including both open and endoscopic skull-based surgery and stereotactic radiosurgery.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And then we're also very fortunate to have Dr. Gardner here. Dr. Paul Gardner, would you mind introducing yourself for us?
Paul Gardner at the University of Pittsburgh. I run the cranial base center here. Also do a combination of endoscopic endonasal and open skull-based surgery. As my practice, I do not do radiosurgery myself, but obviously I'm a firm believer coming from the University of Pittsburgh.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much. I think to start off, Dr. Link, would you mind giving us a summary of the article for us and you know, specifically what made you choose to study lower cranial nerve schwannomas to begin with?
Thanks, Jeff. So first of all, I really want to give credit to Lucas Karlstrom, who was our skull-based fellow last year, who put this data together along with the rest of our skull-based team here in Rochester. And the reason why Lucas and I got interested in this is naturally we had a patient together. And we were just talking about our philosophy and maybe how it's evolved over the more than 25 years of my career, how we approach these things. And admittedly, as a skull-based surgeon, I deal with a lot of cranial nerve deficits, either from pathology or from my own intervention with the pathology. And I have to admit that lower cranial nerve dysfunction is certainly, to me, some of the most devastating and frightening things that happen to patients. And so we started to get interested in that, and basically said, well, let's look at the Mayo Clinic experience with this. And so one of the great things about working here is the Mayo Medical Record is unique in that. It's very well organized. It's been kept since the beginning of time. So we could look back basically over 30 years. So from 1992 to 2021, we could look at our experience treating lower cranial nerve schwannomas. And we included any pathologically verified schwannoma that arose from 9, 10, 11, or 12. We excluded NF2 patients. And all the patients had to have at least 1 year of clinical and radiographic follow-up. And when we did that, so over 30 years, we only came up with 64 patients, only about two a year, which, you know, right now as a group, we probably see almost 200 vestibular schwannomas in a year, but only a couple lower cranial nerve schwannomas per year. And then we had to exclude seven patients because we just didn't have follow-up. So it left us with 58 patients. And one of the sort of side projects or things we were kind of keenly interested in looking at was, you know, what's the difference between the patients we operate on and the patients we treat with radiosurgery? And so we had 34 that had primary surgery and 24 that had primary radiosurgery. So pretty evenly matched groups in terms of numbers and demographics in terms of patient age and so on. But obviously the radiosurgery tumors were smaller. And the kind of the punchline from my standpoint, not unexpectedly at all, but operating on these patients results frequently in new deficits that they did not have before the operation. But somewhat surprisingly and encouragingly, and has kept me from jumping out of the eighth floor window that I'm sitting next to, is that a lot of times the patients recover from those deficits well, which was really gratifying, just again, because my perception is when somebody gets a high vagal nerve injury, it's a bad deficit to try and recover from. Obviously affects their speech and swallowing, and it can certainly impair their airway, so it can become a life-threatening deficit indeed. So that's what kind of got us interested in this. And I just thought Lucas did such a great job in terms of collating this data, and we could really go back and look at it in a very granular way. And that's what prompted us to write the paper.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that summary. Dr. Gardner, did you want to start us off with any questions before we started going through some of the results?
I really enjoyed this paper myself, just because I do think it's a very good summary or reflection of, I think, how a lot of us do practice when it comes to lower cranial nerve schwannomas. That's a difficult philosophy to capture in a paper, but I think this paper does an excellent job of it.
Perfect. I had one question to start off before we go into some of the results. What are some of the factors that guide your decision-making for these cranial nerve schwannomas? Obviously size, nerve deficit, just because it's something that's so rare that even a busy skull-based surgeon is clearly not going to see a lot of. What are sort of the lessons learned that you would pass on to somebody that's deciding what to do with one?
I would say that our philosophy has gotten really solidified over the years in terms of how we approach these. So, and you nailed it in terms of its size and presenting deficits. So a patient who presents with basically no lower cranial nerve deficits, most of these tumors are vagal nerve schwannomas. You know, I've been convinced I've seen maybe one glossopharyngeal schwannoma, and I've seen two accessory nerve schwannomas and a small number of hypoglossal schwannomas, but most of these are arising from the vagal rootlets, undoubtedly the sensory aspect of the vagal rootlets. But the other thing I found is even with conservative surgery, thinking, okay, I'm not going to take all the tumor out, I've preserved all the vagal rootlets and I've debulked the tumor significantly and gotten it down to a very small intracranial volume, I've been discouraged that the patient will wake up with a hoarse voice and difficulty swallowing, even though I could stimulate, the vagus nerve rootlets. And it's usually the lower rootlets, which are the motor rootlets of the vagus nerve. I could stimulate those at low amplitude, and I thought, oh, this is going to be fine. And yet the patient wakes up with a deficit. And again, it can be a devastating deficit for somebody to try and work through. So if the tumor, is less than about 2 centimeters in the cerebellopontine angle and the patient has no deficit, we strongly, strongly lean towards just doing radiosurgery, because the risk of inducing a vagal nerve deficit, and as we showed in the paper, we can look at that in a bit, is low with radiosurgery. There's some risk, but if we operate, even with conservative surgery, I found that there's a greater risk that the patient's going to have a deficit. And it's rare, less than 50% of the time where we say we've taken out all of the tumor and they don't require any additional treatment. Again, if it's a vagal nerve deficit, a vagal nerve schwannoma, I would say that occurs almost never, that we take all the tumor out.
Right.
The other thing that's worth emphasizing is even when the patient shows up and their vocal cord is out, if you take all the tumor out, they almost always are worse. So they might say, yeah, I've got a little bit of trouble swallowing and my voice is really hoarse. And you say, great, now we've got free rein to take this tumor out and cure the patient. They wake up, in my experience, they struggle a lot with their swallowing. Of course, their voice is still hoarse, but that's been discouraging. And it's taught me that while their vocal cord can be out, that's not the only thing the vagus nerve does. And there's a very, you know, important sensory part to swallowing. There's a sort of an automatic part to swallowing that still may be somewhat intact. And when you manipulate the nerve rootlets to get the tumor out, you may take that away and they may be worse.
Yeah, I was going to echo that. There's no question that you can always make swallowing worse. It's the one function that can have that dramatic impact on quality of life. You know, it's the dirty secret of skull-based surgery. We love to show these great outcomes in pre- and post-operative MRIs, but the truth is for schwannoma of any nerve, even though it only comes from one rootlet of that whole nerve, especially when you start looking at the vagus nerve, these little tiny hair-like rootlets become very adherent, whether it's through inflammation or other processes to the tumor, and that separation inevitably makes them worse. So, you know, kudos to you for including that. One question I have along those lines and relevant to that is that, you know, you do mention that many of these, in fact, majority of them have significant improvement, but one thing that you can't really find in the paper is that, you know, many of them, about I think 40 something percent also had thyroplasty or vocal cord injection or some sort of manipulation of the vocal cord to improve that function. Is that included in that, or, you know, or yes.
Yes. Yeah. So we're talking about subjective improvement. And of course, one of the problems is there's no grading scale for swallowing, right? So, you know, we can talk about facial nerve recoveries with the Hauss-Brackmann scale, or we can get an audiogram and look at hearing. But, you know, basically we need the Gardner grading scale for swallowing to know, you know, and we are not shy about being aggressive with, you know, vocal cord injections or thyroplasties or those kinds of things to improve that function. And basically, all we could say is was the patient better? Did they get their feeding gastrostomy out? But, you know, I would say the great majority of patients don't go back to normal, meaning they can eat as fast as they could eat before. So a lot of patients complain, yes, I can eat most everything I want, but it takes me twice as long as everybody else at the table. So that's a little bit of a, you know, a socially awkward thing, or they can't eat certain foods, like dried foods is a common complaint. You know, I can't eat bread, or I can't eat, you know, tough meat like steak, you know. So I suspect for most of us listening, you know, if you said you can't eat bread and you can't eat steak, and say, wow, what's the point of being alive, right? Those are two of the great pleasures of eating right there. So,
absolutely. Michael, I'll defer to you on swallowing, but I think one of the things that's sort of nice as a surgeon when I read this paper is that this is one of the areas that there are a lot of descriptions of approaches in and around this area, but especially lower cranial nerve schwannomas can run anywhere from intradurally at the CP angle all the way down into the infratemporal fossa and into the neck. And it's an enjoyable thing to try to be creative and figure out which aspect of the approach from a retrosigmoid all the way down to a transcervical or a combination of those do you employ for a certain tumor. And, you know, I was sort of curious, how do you make that decision? Where is your cutoff? When do you do the full neck dissection versus just a retromastoid? And I also like your description in that you don't try to get too complicated, and there are a lot of eponymous designations for different approaches, and you really simplify it. But is there a cutoff for when you add the neck dissection to the retrosigmoid, or what is your thought process and approach selection?
So if we're going to operate, it's usually because it's a larger tumor, you know, not a good single fraction radiosurgery target. And usually the patient has some deficit going in. And what we're really thinking about is how can we get this down to a nice radiosurgical volume? So for a large tumor that has a big intracranial component and a big upper cervical component, then we want to do both procedures you know, usually at the same anesthetic, same day, those kinds of things. I have gotten increasingly reluctant to do the big, you know, mastoid, transjugular, transcervical, because number one, you almost always have to occlude the distal sigmoid sinus and jugular vein in the neck. Now, most people tolerate that, but some patients will have at least transient elevated ICP, and you got to deal with more CSF leak issues and so on. And a patient may show up with only a vagal nerve deficit, or what you think is a significant vagal nerve deficit. But if you were going to do that dissection and completely clean out the jugular foramen, you know, you're going to hurt 9 and 11 as well. And, you know, they all meet up with 12 right at the skull base. So you put 12, and the combination of 10 and 12 deficit is much more difficult to deal with than just a 10 nerve deficit, it turns out.
You don't think that that broader exposure gives you the ability to more carefully decide? You think it rather will tempt you to go into the jugular foramen more than you might?
Yeah. Yeah, I think for us it's true that so we've, you know, except for rare instances, you know, where it's just a giant tumor and the patient has a lot of deficit going in, we've kind of shied away from doing the big, you know, transjugular approach and take out the part in the CP angle up to the jugular foramen, take out the part in the neck to get it at least up to C1. And then we have a nice volume we can treat with radiosurgery, either planned or in the future if there's growth of the remnant.
Mike, you know, I don't know if we want to jump into the results or, you know, I have a couple more things I'd like to know your thoughts on, but I'll sort of, for Dr. Traylor, I would like to proceed.
Sure. Let's at least get it through a couple slides here and then we can return back. We've got plenty of time. I wanted to talk first about this first table here. This is table one for those of you listening. This talking about some of the symptoms at pre-op. And most of these make sense. I think that the surgical cohort here has higher rates of dysphagia. I would assume that those are larger tumors with more brainstem dysfunction. And it would make sense, for example, that a hypoglossal nerve schwannoma would have more tongue weakness. But were there any other symptoms that were more specific or a little bit, you know, maybe strange that correlated with one location of a schwannoma over another that you noticed?
No, in fact, I was surprised how little difference there was between the two cohorts. If you look at table one, you know, most of the things, you know, and admittedly, the numbers aren't large, right? The statistics are you should be skeptical of the statistics anyway. But for the most part, the two groups didn't vary significantly, with the exception of basically patients who underwent surgery were more likely to be symptomatic. They were more likely to have larger tumors with brainstem compression and certainly more likely to have hydrocephalus. That's one of the indications to operate is to decompress the posterior fossa, try and relieve the hydrocephalus. So I think that's what really stood out to us. And everything else was pretty much, and the other thing is, neck and shoulder pain was more likely in the surgery group and headache was more likely in the surgical group. And though that's always, you know, even though we tell patients, you know, we're not operating to fix your headache or necessarily to fix your pain. I think patients are more eager to have an intervention if they're having pain.
Absolutely. And Dr. Gardner, stop me at any point if your question, you know, this table here I wanted to talk about was about surgical approach, if your question pertains to that. But just wanted to pick your brain a little bit about what made you choose one surgical approach over the other. I know we talked a little bit about neck dissection, but it seems like retrosigmoid was pretty common for lower brainstem or lower cranial nerve schwannomas, like 11 and 12. Did you utilize the far lateral, for example, more often for those?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So for, I can recall one really large 11th nerve schwannoma that, you know, went through the foramen magnum and then a far lateral worked just great. And same thing with for the hypoglossal schwannomas, to be able to access the hypoglossal canal. And when I say far lateral or we say far lateral, you know, the great majority of those cases we're just drilling up to the condyle, maybe a little bit into the condyle. None of the patients required a fusion. We didn't do a complete condylectomy, for instance. But we do go as far as to the hypoglossal canal, which, you know, Dr. Roten, one of his favorite questions, you know, was sort of a true or false. The hypoglossal canal is within the occipital condyle. And he would say that's false. It's actually just superior to the occipital condyle. So you can drill to it without destabilizing the head on the neck. I don't know, Paul, do you have any experience, you know, completely drilling out the hypoglossal canal? And have you had to do a fusion after you've done that?
It is difficult actually to destabilize a patient from a far lateral. You really, in my experience, you have to do what's called perhaps an extreme lateral, where you mobilize the vertebral artery away from the condyle C1 joint to be able to really drill enough of it. Through just the far lateral exposure, I find that you can drill some of the jugular tubercle and certainly a fair amount of the condyle, but to really do enough to destabilize is actually difficult. So I would agree completely.
Wonderful. I think that we can go back to your questions, Dr. Gardner. We can circle back to some of the postoperative outcomes, if that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing that I think is very nice and that I think I'm in complete agreement on is this. I think this represents an appropriately conservative approach to a disease that I think all of us have seen surgery potentially cause real problems with, but it obviously has a role. But one thing that's not caught in this paper is how often do you observe lower cranial nerve schwannomas? What are your criteria for observation versus treatment, even if it's radiosurgery, say for a smaller, even perhaps more difficult, is a medium-sized tumor that is maybe not an ideal radiosurgical target?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, a great point. And certainly we have a lot of these tumors under observation. Obviously, particularly in an older person, an incidentally discovered small tumor, I would have no problem following. But at the same time, always in the back of my mind is, number one, is the patient going to get lost to follow up and show up with a worse problem that's going to be more difficult to deal with? And also, for a small tumor, the risk of radiosurgery is very low. So I think, well, you know, depending on how risk adverse the patient is, a lot of times I'll say, you have this small tumor, all your nerves are working well. If we do radiosurgery, there's a high chance they'll continue to work well and a high chance that your tumor will not grow. So I think that becomes a very much, you know, example of clinical equipoise in terms of what to do. For a lot of small asymptomatic tumors, I will kind of lean towards saying, I think we should just treat it now, and then it's treated, and hopefully we don't have to worry about it, but I have to keep following you.
Yeah, I think you really need a reliable patient for observation, but I guess I tend to lead more than that. I was a little surprised that, you know, you did have about a 29% complication, let's call it, rate, or subjective worsening is perhaps a better way to put it, in the radiosurgery group, which was a little surprising to me. Do you have any comments on what do you think that comes from, or the majority of the complication there is?
Yeah, so a couple of them I would say were real, significant complications where the patient, you know, had a significant amount of trouble swallowing. Everything else, I would say, and then we had a hearing loss in there as well, I believe. But everything else was very mild and transient. But we had, you know, two episodes of patients, 8%, that had real swallowing trouble. And why exactly those two patients had that, I can't come up with a real answer to that. Why were they different than the other 22 patients? I don't know.
Mike, another question I have, you've also put out a fantastic paper looking at subjective quality of life for patients with vestibular schwannoma, showing actually a negative effect on quality of life with either residual or treated tumor, but tumor left in a patient's head, that there's some sort of impact on quality of life of simply knowing that that's there. Do you think that that plays a role in this decision making, or do you think in this setting, the impact of treatment or surgery on quality of life outweighs any psychological impact on that residual tumor?
Yeah, I think it's the latter, Paul. I think it's, and it's a different counseling discussion. I mean, most of the time when we're operating on a vestibular schwannoma, our goal is we want to cure the patient. We want to take it out. And so there may be some psychological disadvantage of then saying to the patient, well, we couldn't get it all out. For these cases, I mean, we are very upfront often that, you know, our goal is not to take all the tumor out. It's to get the brainstem decompressed or resolve the hydrocephalus or get this mass down so we can do, you know, plan B of your treatment, which is radiosurgery. But I think it's absolutely the swallowing trouble, the voice changes, you know, sometimes shoulder weakness and pain. That's what badly affects the patients.
And do you think a schwannoma is a schwannoma is a schwannoma? In other words, I can treat a trigeminal schwannoma the same as a vestibular and the same as a lower cranial nerve and expect the same response, say, to radiosurgery?
I don't think it's true, interestingly. I have zero data to support what I just said. I have no science behind it. But for instance, I find the facial schwannomas don't respond as well as the vestibular schwannomas. And I actually treat at a little bit of a higher dose for the lower cranial nerve schwannomas. For the vestibular schwannomas, it's about 12 and a half gray to the 50% isodose line, 12 and a half to 13 gray. But for these tumors, I tend to go 14 gray. Just number one, a lot of the fall off of the radiation is below the skull base, so there's not a critical structure there. And I am concerned that they don't respond as well.
I have to agree with you. Anecdotally, a similar experience. You know, one other question overall, was there anything you learned putting this paper together and writing it that perhaps you were a little surprised or that you took away as a point that perhaps changed how you practice?
Yeah, I think the main things were that a lot of the patients did get better. So I just find it discouraging to, you know, go in on post-op day one and, you know, they've got a Yonkar suction in their hand because they can't even control their saliva well and their voice is terrible. And but those things get better. Most people will learn to swallow again, even with a complete high vagal nerve deficit. And the other thing, is that it's important to be aggressive with the rehab early. So I now counsel patients, look, you're gonna need a PEG tube to get through this. And then you're gonna learn to swallow and you're gonna get that out and get on with the rest of your life. And if a patient's having any difficulty with their airway at all, I think we've learned to become aggressive with tracheostomy so they don't get into trouble at 3 a.m. at post-op day two and, you know, something bad happens. So I think those are the main things. And I think overall, I've learned that even not being aggressive in surgery can result in a deficit. And so I probably am pessimistic in my counseling to patients. What's their chance of having some dysphagia or dysphonia, even with a conservative operation?
Wonderful. I think that we sort of indirectly talked about table four, which is for the listeners, the radiation managed lower cranial nerve schwannomas. I think last thing we need to touch on here is some of the post-surgical outcomes, which we've been talking about some, but I just wanted to go through it a little bit more formally. It looks like dysphagia, unsurprisingly, is one of the more common ones that you see. Any other, I guess we've talked a little bit about this before, sort of with the pre-op symptoms, but any specific risks for dysphagia by nerve of origin, for example, vagal nerve, it seems like you may have alluded to, may have some more trouble swallowing post-op.
Yeah, I think, and like I say, I've only been convinced one time that it was a tumor coming from the glossopharyngeal nerve, But I think if the tumor is coming from the rootlets of the vagus nerve, there's a very high chance they're going to have at least transient dysphagia and dysphonia. And, you know, in our series here of only 34 patients, it was 70%. And you know, one of those patients needed a tracheostomy. It was so severe.
Wonderful. Just wanted to add here, I think it's, you know, it's remarkable that you have about 5 years of median follow-up for these patients, which is, I mean, it's incredible. Really adds to some of the weight of some of the results here, specifically the long-term outcomes. I think we're nearing the end here. Dr. Gardner, did you have any other sort of last minute questions before we begin to close out?
No, just, you know, one comment. I think one of my big takeaways from this is, you know, I think skull-based surgery, I think fortunately, largely because of radiosurgery, has moved away from this era of, you know, what's the biggest approach I can do and show a perfect post-operative MRI. And I think this paper really reinforces that philosophy. You know, we like to think that if I do a radical resection, I've cured the patient. But, and that may be true in some cases, in many cases, but if you look at this paper, the control rates are phenomenal. They're approaching 100%. They're 96 to 97% in all of these patients. So this does treat that patient's tumor. These tumors are not going to kill the patient. And so, and that's even with only, what, 41% gross total resection. And it's similar to what they present in the systematic review. So I think this really reinforces for this particular tumor type, this philosophy and this way of approaching it, I believe is the appropriate management.
Perfect, thank you so much. I think we're nearing the end here. I wanted to ask one more question or sort of a statement maybe. Dr. Link, we started doing this with a lot of these episodes, but what is your biggest takeaway from this paper for our audience that could be a resident learning this, a skull-based fellow, or maybe a skull-based surgeon who doesn't see a lot of these? What is sort of the takeaway you'd give them from this data?
Well, I think you know, this is a diagnosis that I think, as Paul alluded to, is well served by a multimodality treatment. And like almost, well, I'll say with everything in skull-based surgery, a big team is a big help. You know, you need people who can help with swallowing rehab, with voice rehab. And these are patients you have to take care of on a very detailed manner. You have to see them back frequently, make sure they're maintaining their nutrition and their weight and are doing okay and not out there struggling.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Okay, I think that we'll wrap it up here. I want to say formally thank you, Dr. Link, for joining us, and to our guest faculty, Dr. Gardner as well. It was great having you both on and discussing this topic. I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and I hope that you'll join us for the next Journal Club podcast. As a reminder, this podcast activity is available to claim for 1.5 CME and is complimentary to all CNS members through the online education catalog. Thank you all so much. We'll see you next time.